Empty Tomb Accounts, Part 2, the fourth talk in a series entitled Is the Bible Trustworthy? Responding to Bart Ehrman, was presented by Jack Crabtree on December 11, 2011 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2011. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The handout and notes to which Dr. Crabtree refers in this talk is handout number 3 in this series.
As most of you know, I'm winding together two different series, one on biblical philosophy and one on Is the Bible Reliable? This will be the last of my talks on Is the Bible Reliable for a while, and we'll go back in January to biblical philosophy. Okay, I hope this is not too redundant, but I need to go back now and do an Easterly thing in this Christmas season and talk about the accounts of the empty tomb. Let me just review briefly what we went over last week. I will be working off the same outline. If you have the outline from last week, that's the outline I'll be working off of. But just as a way of review, what happened during that last week of Jesus' life? He was crucified, I argued, on a Wednesday morning, was buried before sundown on Wednesday, before the Sabbath, which would have been Thursday, not the weekly Sabbath that comes every Friday dusk to Saturday dawn, not the weekly Sabbath, but the Sabbath that was prescribed in the Mosaic Covenant for the first of the days of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which immediately followed the Passover. So you had You had the Passover, and then you began the Feast of Unleavened Bread for 7 days, the first day of which and the last day of which were Sabbath days, holy Sabbaths unto the Lord. So he was buried on Wednesday before the sun went down, before the beginning of the holy Sabbath of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. That's why Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea had to hurry to get him into the tomb. They did so, and they wrapped him in spices. There were a number of women who had followed Jesus from Galilee who looked on from a distance so that they knew what had happened to the body of Jesus. The next day then was a Sabbath, and nothing happens among his disciples. The Jews do go to Pilate and say, Jesus said that after 3 days, he was going to rise from the dead. So I think we better post a guard on the tomb, lest his disciples come and steal the body and claim a resurrection, and things will be worse than they were before we killed him. So Pilate says, you've got a guard. You guard it. You seal it. So the Jews, the Sanhedrin, evidently posts some soldiers from the temple guard that was under their jurisdiction, and they put a seal on the stone that would have traditionally and typically been placed in front of a tomb. They sealed it, I assume a wax seal, and by pain of death probably, you were not to break that seal. So they put a seal on it, and they guard it. The Sabbath comes to an end. Now we have Friday. Friday is a work day now, and the women apparently go into the market and buy spices and prepare the spices to get them ready to go and prepare the body. Not exactly clear why, whether they were concerned about the incompetence of the men or they didn't see the men embalm the body. Probably the former, but they're going to do it right. So they're getting the spices prepared to go back and prepare the body the next chance they get. But the next chance they get, for some reason, I mean, they can't fit it all into that day, apparently. But the next thing that happens is the weekly Sabbath, Friday dusk to Saturday dusk. Did I say dawn earlier? From Friday dusk to Saturday dusk. They can't do anything because it's the weekly Sabbath. Then it's dark. So the first chance that they have to go to the tomb is early on the first day of the week on Sunday morning. So they're carrying their spices together. They break, I'm arguing, into two parties. One group of women is apparently carrying the spices, about 75 pounds worth of spices, 100 pounds, Roman pounds, which are about 3/4 of our pound. So about 75 pounds of spices that they're carrying to the tomb. One group is carrying the material. One group of women goes on ahead to observe the tomb and figure out what they need to figure out about how they might gain access to the body. And therein lies the key to understanding how to reconcile these accounts. Because one account says that one angel spoke to them. Another account says that two men spoke to them. Which was it, one angel or two men? I'm arguing that the reason those don't reconcile is because they are not the same event. The first event was one angel speaking to the first group of women. The second event was two men, they are called, speaking to the second group of people. They say different things. So it seems clear to me they're not the same event, because the message given to them is not close enough to be the same event. So the one angel says one thing, the two men say a different thing to the second set of women, and both of them are sent back to the disciples who are gathered apparently in the upper room. We don't know for sure, but wherever they are in hiding, they go back to report to them that the tomb is empty. They get there, they come with somewhat conflicting stories, and in the confusion, mostly the disciples don't believe them, but Mary Magdalene, apparently in particular, persuades Peter and John to come have a look. So Peter and John go back to the empty tomb, Mary Magdalene follows them back, and the other women in Mary Magdalene's party, or some other women, apparently follow Mary Magdalene. Peter goes into the tomb, sees that it's empty. John goes into the tomb, sees that it's empty, and they head home. Mary Magdalene apparently lingers behind at the empty tomb. Another angel, or is it two? One or two, I don't remember which. Angel appear to Mary Magdalene at that point. She turns, looks out away from the tomb, sees who she thinks is the gardener, and begins speaking to him. Tell us where you have taken the body. Jesus calls her by name. She recognizes that it's Jesus. They have a brief conversation about them. The other women who have followed Mary Magdalene apparently come along as well. They cling to the feet of Jesus, and Jesus speaks to them, sends them back to the disciples once again to tell them that they have seen Jesus. So those are the accounts. I think that's the event, the way that it happened. The two keys to reconciling the account is noticing that Luke, in particular, records a different event from Matthew and Mark. What looks like the inability to reconcile the accounts comes from believing that they're intending to describe the same account when they are not. One is the account of one group of women, and the other two are the account of a different group of women, and that's why they don't look the same. The other key is to recognize that Mary Magdalene's visit that John records in his gospel, John actually includes two separate visits of Mary Magdalene to the empty tomb. The first one, she's the first group of women to arrive at the tomb and see that it's empty. She goes back to the disciples as the angels had instructed her and reports to them. Then she returns with James and John, and that's where she talks to another angel and ultimately sees Jesus and speaks with Jesus. That's a different episode. That's another key to understanding how to reconcile these accounts. Then a third key to reconciling all of these accounts with the rest of the New Testament is to realize that there are two Sabbaths that are being spoken of. The Sabbath that is the day after Passover, and the weekly Sabbath several days later. Now, there's some objections that somebody could raise to my reconstruction of this account. One of them would be that Matthew's account is inconsistent with my version with regard to the chronology, that there are not two Sabbaths a Friday death, or that Matthew is trying to describe a Friday death, a Saturday Sabbath, and a Sunday resurrection, and that's what Matthew says. Well, that's not what my reconstruction argues, so my reconstruction is incompatible with Matthew. But note that in Matthew 27:62, speaking of the day after the death, he says, on the next day, the day after the preparation. Now, that term preparation is a technical term within Judaism. The day of preparation is the day before any Sabbath day. So whenever you have a Sabbath day, you have to like cook double portions and do all kinds of things to get ready to not be working on the Sabbath. And that day of extra work and extra preparation is called a day of preparation. Well, the day after the preparation would be the Sabbath day. So on the next day, the day after the preparation, is, I would argue, the day after the Passover, upon which Jesus was crucified. And yet later in Matthew's account, he talks about now after the Sabbath, as it began to dawn toward the first day of the week. Well, that's clearly indicating the weekly Sabbath. Now, Matthew's not being explicit, but his account certainly leaves room for those not being the same Sabbath. Matthew just isn't making it explicit. Well, one thing that you learn in looking at Matthew's accounts carefully is that's the very kind of confusing lack of precision that is throughout Matthew's gospel. Matthew's gospel has an intrinsic nature to it that's very different than our modern expectations. He's not bothering to cue us into the fact that something is not exactly chronological or that something doesn't exactly immediately follow in time immediately after the last thing. He leaves it for us to decipher those things from other clues that we have. So whereas we may very well think that we may assume that Matthew is talking about a Friday death, Saturday Sabbath, and Sunday resurrection, there's nothing about his account that requires that or makes it clear that that's what he's doing. Matthew doesn't mention Nicodemus in his account. Is that a problem? It's not a problem because all of history is written selectively. The only gospel account that mentions Nicodemus is John, and John is the only gospel account that even cares about Nicodemus. In other words, Nicodemus is mentioned in the account of the empty tombs because John is interested in focusing on Nicodemus. He has a whole chapter in chapter 3 of the Gospel of John devoted to Nicodemus. When Nicodemus, relatively early in Jesus' ministry, comes to Jesus by night out of fear of being observed talking to Jesus, and they have a very interesting conversation. And we wouldn't even know what the outcome of that is if this account in John, where he is helping Joseph of Arimathea bury Jesus, we wouldn't have known that the outcome of Nicodemus' life was that he became a disciple. But he did, and John is interested in telling us that story, so he mentions Nicodemus' participation in the burial of Jesus. Matthew, Mark, and Luke don't mention Nicodemus, but Nicodemus would be just totally out of the blue in their account. There's no reason to mention him. There's nothing gained by mentioning him. There's no purpose to it in their account. But there clearly is a purpose to it in John's account. So that's why he's there, but not in the other three Gospels. Matthew, some might argue, thinks that Mary Magdalene saw the angel who rolled the stone away actually sitting on the stone. I think you even have photographs or pictures of that have been painted where, well, not photographs. Well, I think I saw it on a newsstand somewhere. Pictures painted of the women approaching the tomb and the angel is sitting on the stone that's been rolled away. You could read Matthew's account that way, but again, the question is, what's the nature, the intrinsic nature of the kind of writing that Matthew is producing? It's the kind of writing where you can be misled by it if you come with the wrong expectations. if you expect to follow immediately in sequence, then that's the impression you would get. But clearly, when you read the Matthew account, that's not what Matthew intends. He tells about Mary coming to the tomb, approaching it the first day of the week, and then he goes back in time. An earthquake had occurred, and the angel of the Lord had come and rolled away the stone and was sitting on it, and the guards shook with fear, etc., etc. I don't have it verbatim, but that's roughly what he tells. But it's a flashback in time, quite apparently so. Even the Greek tenses would suggest that he's going back in time to say, what is it that occurred such that this woman who's going to the tomb, or these women, I should say, who is going to the tomb is going to find it, the stone rolled away and empty. Why is that? Well, he told the account. He gave a description of what had happened earlier. But then he immediately goes into, and the angel said to her. Well, he doesn't notice the lack of detail in Matthew. He doesn't even talk about her going into the tomb. Doesn't even talk about her seeing an angel. So again, the nature of Matthew's account is to be completely absent those kinds of details. He doesn't speak with the kind of precision that tells the story, that allows us to picture the story accurately. He's giving us facts that are relevant to us. That's the nature of his account. And the next fact that's relevant to us, now that we know that Mary had access to the tomb because the stone was rolled away, is that she got spoken to by an angel. There's nothing about that, the account and the language that's used there, that would require that angel even to be the same angel as the angel who rolled away the stone. It may have been. We don't know. But in any case, there's no reason to think that that angel is still sitting on the stone. So in the other accounts where the angel appears to them, I believe inside in that case, inside the tomb, it might have been just outside, but standing there, there's no reason to think that that's not what Matthew is talking about, the angel that was standing there and instructing them. So it's not really incompatible with the account that I gave. The most misleading thing in Matthew's account is that Matthew appears to report that the women saw Jesus immediately after leaving the tomb the first time to go and tell the disciples. If you just read Matthew's account straight through, you might very well think that they see the angel says, go and report what you have seen to the other disciples. And then the next thing that he says is, behold, Jesus met them and greeted them. So if you could easily come to the conclusion that's the next thing that happened. What I've argued is they take a trip back to the disciples, have come back again to the tomb, and it's the second time visiting the tomb that Jesus meets them and greets them. Have we been misled by Matthew then, if I am right? Well, no, not really. Not unless we choose to insist that the nature of his account is to give us the next thing that immediately happened. But as we've seen, that's not the way Matthew writes. That's not what sorts of expectations we can legitimately have when we're dealing with the Gospel of Matthew. Because Matthew has this very matter-of-fact style where he goes from relevant fact to relevant fact to relevant fact to relevant fact. It's not his purpose to paint a picture for us. It's not his purpose to give us a realistic rendering of what went down. This is not realism. This is abstract art. It's the significance of the event for Matthew that comes to the forefront. This was a significant fact. This was a significant fact. This was a significant fact. And this is a significant fact. You put it together. John, on the other hand, when he opts to give you an account at all, it's full of detail and a very realistic and precise description of what happened. Okay, Mark and Luke, with respect to the chronology, are they consistent? Mark and Luke are even more clear than is Matthew. They have to be including two Sabbaths in their account. Luke tells us that the women prepared the spices between the end of the Sabbath and the dawning of the first day of the week. How would they do that? Wait, did I get that right? Between the end of the Sabbath and the... I don't remember. Let me read it here. Luke's chronology is a Friday death, a Saturday Sabbath, a Sunday visit to the tomb. Is that actually right? No, that's not Luke's chronology. For Luke's account to make any sense, there needs to be a time for them, the women, to prepare spices and perfumes between their observing Jesus' burial the few minutes before the Sabbath begins and their beginning their Sabbath day rest the day before they go to the empty tomb at early dawn on Sunday morning. Okay, so the way Luke's account goes, between the time of observing Jesus being crucified and the body being taken down and buried in the tomb, between the time that they observed where it was laid and the Sabbath day, which is like minutes later, right, they had to prepare the perfumes and spices. That's impossible. But it's not impossible if that Sabbath they didn't prepare the spices between the burial and that Sabbath, but they had a whole day to do it after that Sabbath on Friday before the next Sabbath. And so they spent the whole day Friday going to the market, we find out from Luke, I believe, buying spices, going to the market, buying spices, preparing them, and getting all ready to go and bury the body. That happens on Friday, not in the split second between the end of the day of preparation and the Sabbath day, the next day. So there's no way that Luke's account can make any sense unless there are two Sabbaths. And the same is basically true of Mark. The only way you could make it a Friday, Saturday, and Sunday crucifixion, Sabbath, resurrection for Mark would be if the time they were buying and preparing the spices was Saturday night after sundown, which would no longer be the Sabbath, and then early the next morning. There's enough time there to do that. The question is it plausible in that day, in that pre-Edison era, that they would have used torches or whatever to go, and is the market open in that culture at that time of night? I don't think they went to Walmart. I think they could not have had access to any merchant who would have been selling spices during the night in their culture. Now, maybe I'm wrong about that, but it just seems plausible to me that that's not even an option in their culture. So you put all of them together, and all of them can be reconciled if you have a Wednesday crucifixion and a Sunday resurrection, but you have run into all kinds of problems if you try to fit it into the Friday, Saturday, Sunday thing. I think I've answered all the questions on those. Let me make review one last comment, and then I'll open it up for your questions. On your last outline on page 8, it'd be the capital letter E, I asked the question, does it really matter how many times the rooster sounded in Peter's denials or how many angels were in the empty tomb? Why are we trying to reconcile these passages? Let me just remind you. I don't care how many angels spoke to them. I don't care how many times the rooster sounded. Nothing hinges on that. There's nothing of theological or doctrinal import that is logically tied to those kinds of details. However, what we're going to see is that people like Dr. Ehrman and people of his ilk, their argument is these are not trustworthy accounts. And how do I know they are not trustworthy accounts? Because they're irreconcilable. You can't reconcile them. What does that suggest to someone like a biblical critic? Well, that suggests that these are not written by people who, out of one single mind, out of their eyewitness testimony or the eyewitness testimony of other people that have informed them, are putting together a coherent account based on facts, based on truth, based on historical reality. That's not what we have. What we have are stories that were made up decades, maybe even centuries later, that had nothing to do with history, had nothing to do with fact, had nothing to do with reality. These are just stories that these weird people called Christians began to tell themselves. you know, somebody in the middle of the first century, for example, got the idea that Jesus was still with us. He may have died decades earlier, but Jesus is somehow still with us. How can I dramatize the fact that Jesus is still with us? Let me tell a story that describes how he didn't really stay dead in the grave, but he was raised again. And that would explain, and that would emphasize, and that would dramatize for people how Jesus is still with us. Did the person who told that story think that it was historically accurate? No. Did the person who told that story, did he have any basis to know whether it was true or happened or not? No, he was much older. I mean, he came along much later, I should say. He wasn't there. He was an eyewitness. So we shouldn't take this stuff as being grounded in history and in truth and, in fact, in reality. These are just like good ideas that Christians invented. And the Gospels take those various good ideas and stitch them together and patch them together into what we now read in the New Testament. Well, that matters to me. I don't care how many angels told them that Jesus was risen from the dead, but the fact that he's risen from the dead is critical. Because if Jesus wasn't risen from the dead, then we're a bunch of idiots. Because our whole hope rests on the fact that we believe in history and in truth and in fact. God has committed himself to taking a people for himself who are going to survive the grave, are going to survive death, and are going to be given existence in the age to come forever without death, without evil, without futility. I mean, that's what we believe. That's why we celebrate Christmas. That's why we get excited about this kind of thing, because we believe that's true. Well, do I believe it because somebody in the middle of the first century had like a good idea? Or do I believe it because God, the God who's there, the God who authors history and who controls and governs history, is actually committed to bringing that to pass and has promised to us that that's our destiny? Well, if there really was a tomb there that was empty that people actually saw, then that gives credence to the fact that the God who really is there and promised us that is really committed to bringing it to pass. But if no one ever saw the empty tomb, then what do we believe in? Why do we believe this good idea that some anonymous Christian somewhere in the past, somewhere in history, came up with, thinking that he felt like the presence of Jesus was still with him? You see the difference? Do you feel the difference between those? I think that makes all the difference in the world. And as for me, my commitment, my faith, is based on the fact that it's real, hardcore history that we're making the foundation and the ground of what it is that we believe. So that's why we're reconciling these accounts, because we're trying to answer the challenge of those people who are coming along and saying, you know, you got your Bibles not the way you think you did. You got your Bibles by many anonymous minds throughout time having a bunch of good ideas that led them to literally make up, fictionalize, create stories that captured those good ideas, and eventually those got patched together into these works that we call the Gospels. Well, if that's true, I'm out of here. If that's what I'm reading, why am I bothering? I've got other things to do. It's because I believe that there really was an empty tomb that these women actually did see, that's become the foundation for why I believe what I believe and why I live the way I live. And I would hope that that's true for you as well. Okay, let me open up for your questions about the empty tombs before I go on here.
So if there was a Wednesday crucifixion,
uh-huh,
and a Sunday resurrection,
right,
that's 4 days.
No, he said he'll be in the tomb 3 days and three nights. So the Wednesday is the first night.
Okay.
Wait, I mean,
that makes sense.
Trust me, it works out.
Thanks.
I can't do it in public, but I can do it on paper.
But I get what you're saying. So 3 days, three nights.
Right.
Thanks.
Uh-huh. I'm confused about one thing. So Mary Magdalene She was in with the other Mary. They were the first ones to come to the tomb. Mm-hmm. And was it at that point that they saw an angel spoke to them?
Yes.
Okay, so this is my question. The angel said, "He is risen, go back and tell the disciples." Why does she come again and is crying because she thinks...
She didn't believe it.
She didn't believe it.
Huh?
Oh, she didn't believe what the angel told her?
Mm-mm.
But she went back and told the disciples...
Well, we don't know exactly what she told them.
Well, John says she went back and...
You'll never believe what happened to me. Funny-looking man who was shining brightly told me that Jesus was risen from the dead. I don't know where he is.
Well, in John's account, it looks like she went back and told him, I mean, it would be consistent with that, that she went back and told him that they've taken the body and we don't know where he's laid him.
Exactly.
Okay, so she just didn't even believe the angel.
She doesn't believe him.
So then she goes back and she's crying. And does she see another angel then? Or is that...
She does. She sees an angel. The tomb. And then she turns and she sees who she thinks is the gardener that ends up being Jesus. And notice she says to Jesus, you notice what she asked Jesus, or thinking he's the gardener, "Would you please tell us where you have taken the body?" So she's still thinking that the body is gone, not that he's raised from the dead, but that somebody has taken the body.
Even though John records for himself,
John says
he
himself
believes.
That he believed. Let's see now, let me think. I can't remember. There's some subtlety to that that I just is flying out of my head right at the moment. Maybe I'll think of it, but there's a little subtlety to that too.
So probably angels might... I mean, the angel must have looked pretty ordinary if, like, just the man.
Right,
if she
so
didn't
he's described. Okay, there's another discrepancy that Ehrman points out. Are they men or are they angels? Because some accounts call them men. But notice that all the accounts that call them call them men talk about them having garments that are white, and one of them says shining, talks about how brightly white they are. Well, something's going on, right? I mean, these are not just men. Why is he describing them as men? Because he's describing them. They had the form of a man. They had the appearance of a man. But they were an unusual man because their garments were shining. Angel is not a description. Angel is a role. So Matthew calls them an angel because that's the role they're playing. They're playing the role of messengers. Luke and Mark call them men because that's the appearance that they had. Does that mean they're not playing the role of angels and being messengers? Well, they give messages. So apparently they do mean that they are angels, angelos, but they have the appearance of a man. So they throw their emphasis onto what they look like to them, whereas Matthew is talking about what role they were playing. So there's no conflict there. That's just not even a contradiction.
So Mary Magdalene's mentioned as in the group of women in all four accounts. What is...
Yes. No, not in Luke. Now, Mary Magdalene is mentioned in Luke, but not as coming to the tomb on the first day of the week. That's because Luke is giving the account of the other group of women. Later, then, when it talks about them going back and telling the disciples, they're all there together. And Mary Magdalene is mentioned in that list of women. But that's because they have, you know, those events that Luke describes and Mark and Matthew describe are only minutes apart. So by the time the second group of women makes it back to the upper room, Mary Magdalene and her friends have probably begun to give their account. But then the other women come up behind and they start to give their account. And like I suggested last week, you can imagine trying to sort that out. They're not giving exactly the same account of what they saw. We saw one man. The other says we saw two men. Well, which was it? And the conclusion that the disciples reached is these are hysterical women. They don't know what they're talking about. But I think part of what contributed to the sense that this is just too incoherent to believe is you have two different people giving two different accounts because they're giving accounts of different events.
I just wondered if we'd covered the part where it says in Mark that the women were trembling and bewildered and went out and
No,
fled
I didn't. Thank you.
The tomb.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, one of the things that's odd about Mark's account is it says they told no one.
Right.
Well, that seems to a contradiction. That why would you? How could all the other accounts say they went back and told the disciples, and Mark says they told no one? But notice in the Mark account, why are they leaving? to follow the instructions of the angels to go back and tell the disciples. So I think it's evident even internally to Mark's account that what Mark means by they told no one is they didn't go public with it. I mean, there would have been a distance between the tomb and where the upper room was. They would have gone past a bunch of people going about their business, living their lives, and they could have proclaimed to them, "Wow, you'll never believe what I just saw and what happened to me." I think that's what Mark means by they told no one, is they kept it within the group of disciples. They needed to figure this stuff out. And remember, I don't think they believe yet that he's raised from the dead. They don't believe that. It's significant to recognize that. I mean, we get the impression when people talk about doubting Thomas and about what an unbelieving jerk Thomas was because they told him he was raised from the dead and he didn't believe them. Well, none of these people believed it. The disciples didn't believe the women. The women didn't believe their own eyes. I mean, nobody believed that Jesus was raised from the dead right on the basis of anybody's testimony. So Thomas is not unique in that. He's just wanting to know for himself as well, like they do. Because Thomas has not seen the risen Lord when they tell him, but everyone else has actually seen the risen Lord by that time, but Thomas has not. So everyone involved, no one involved believes on the basis of anybody's testimony. Every one of them believes because Jesus himself appeared to them and confirmed his resurrection by his own presence with them. So there's nothing unusual about Thomas's doubt or his unbelief. What's unusual about Thomas is his confession. My Lord and my God. He realizes the implications of this. This really is the Son of God, who's the embodiment of the person and authority of God himself. And I think that's why that account is included, is because of his confession.
Jack, thank you very much for doing this series. As you know, I think it's real valuable and real important, and I appreciate your doing it. Thank you. I've been gone for a little while, so I wonder if I could ask two questions.
Sure.
One, and they're kind of step back and look at the landscape as a whole questions.
Okay.
Briefly. You can answer briefly. You can ignore them if you want.
Okay.
One of them is the author of this book. The book is Jesus Interrupted. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
his name is Dr. Ehrman.
Bart Ehrman.
Bart Ehrman. First question is, what do you think his purpose in writing the book is? And second, I haven't read the book, but I've seen it, and it looked, I think I read a subtitle somewhere. It said, why scholars know a lot of stuff that churches don't seem to know. Or
revealing the hidden contradiction in the Bible and why we don't know about them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I guess my question is, do you think he's aware that there are bright, credentialed scholars, PhDs in philosophy, who do accept that the biblical record is reliable? Or do you think he's aware that people like that exist? Like, does he interact with them and their views in there at all, or what?
He does not interact with their views. I'm sure he knows that there are people like that out there, but I think he would probably evaluate someone like me as, well, I have this pious commitment to the truth of the Bible, and nothing in the world is going to shake me from that pious commitment. No facts, no arguments, no nothing is going to shake me because I have a religious faith.
That's a lot like you, Jack.
Yeah. And so he would just, I think he would probably just dismiss someone like me as being, well, you know, he's got a religious agenda and a religious commitment, and, you know, good for him, you know.
Condescending, sort of.
Well, I would imagine, but I don't know. I mean, I did see a video of him lecturing once. He seemed like a nice guy.
Sometimes that's why these views, I think, get persuasive for people. Is
sure,
because they're likable people.
Sure, very likable. Yeah.
And then the first question: what's his purpose in writing the book, do you think?
Well, there's the purpose. There's the real purpose ultimately that, you know, all of us have to wonder about all of us, what our real purpose is. His stated purpose is that he wants, and this is, undoubtedly this is true, the attitude toward the Bible that academics have and that's made its way into seminaries, is a very different perspective on the Bible than what you get in the churches. And he rightly, I think, is asking the question, well, that's strange. What's with that? You know, why would you learn one set of things about the Bible in seminary and then go back to the church and teach another one? And he's an agnostic at this point in his life. So especially from his perspective, that seems really dishonest. And I would contend that's dishonest. I think that's very dishonest. If you really don't believe it's the Word of God, why do you go back to church and pretend that it is? Now, that doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, I believe it's the Word of God, and I don't pretend otherwise. I mean, I'm staking my life on that fact. But there are plenty of churches, probably the vast majority of churches, especially mainline denominations, where the pastors have been taught to not trust the Bible in the way that I think they should, and yet they still go through the culture of Christianity. They still promote the culture of Christianity that is founded on the foundation that this stuff is true and that the Bible is true. And I just think that's hypocritical. I mean, I just think that lacks intellectual integrity, and so does he. And I would agree with him in that regard. So he's wanting to kind of poke at that gap between what the leaders of Christianity really believe and what they're pretending out of what he calls a pious fiction that they're playing out in their roles as preachers and ministers and so on.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Jack, I want you to speculate on the nature of belief, because we saw that Mary Magdalene went to the tomb twice and saw angels twice, and I'm trying to put myself in her position. What would my reaction to an angel, of a spiritual, supernatural being, wouldn't that be automatic belief right there? You know, somebody from outer space comes and says, you know, I'm not believing you. But, and then the question, the follow-up question would be, or the related question is, what do you think of, would Ehrman's response be to your explanation? I mean, would he say, I guess, you know, I was wrong, or I.
Okay, I'll talk about that. Talk about that in a second. Coming up, the first one.
What does it take to believe?
Well, angels, you have to get past your confusion.
Yeah,
you have to sort things out, and sorting. I mean, they're being required to go from 0 to 60 in several seconds here, right? Yeah. People don't come back from the dead to. Well, some people do come back from the dead, and you're not going to make that transition without that altering your whole worldview ultimately. Mm-hmm. And rightly, our worldview, we tend to be intellectually conservative, as well we should. I mean, that's not a bad thing to be, that's a good thing to be, where we tend to assume that what we know is true is actually true, and then try to fit everything into that. Well, this is a paradigm buster. Jesus rising from the dead is going to destroy their whole paradigm. Well, because you're intellectually conservative, you don't just go, oh, wow, yeah, people do raise from the dead. You go, whoa, wait a minute. You need some time to process all that and try to figure out how am I going to preserve my sense that I have a knowledge of reality now? How am I going to fit this in? Or if I can't fit it in, what adjustments am I going to make to my paradigm so that I can account for the fact that Jesus is alive? And I just don't think you do that quickly. So this unbelief that they have is actually a very intellectually responsible thing on their part. They're trying to do this with integrity and try to sort it out and try to figure out in a way that is responsible. If you believe too quickly, then you're way too gullible. You're not being intellectually responsible. Quick belief is not good belief, is not sound belief. And I'll answer the second one.
Yeah, so we would be wise to let... I mean, I think I understand that that's part of the modus operandi around here, is that we kind of give each other room and slack to kind of catch up with everybody else, to kind of like wait for other people to come to belief.
Right.
Or stronger belief, or however you want to put it. Right. It takes time to process things sometimes, and we should cut each other. If we're not, we should cut each other some slack. And let
exactly. Because true belief has to be your belief, not my belief imposed on you or somebody else's belief imposed on you. It has to be your belief. And in order for it to be your belief, you're going to have to do the work of figuring out what arguments have weight for you, what evidence has weight for you, and all that kind of stuff. You need to sort all that stuff out. And until you can settle on it and go, yeah, I really believe that's true. But nobody can do that work for you. You have to do that yourself. That's one of the biggest problems in Christian culture, is shut up, kid, and believe. That's what good Christians do. They just shut up and believe. No, they don't. Good Christians think about it first.
Yeah, you probably explained this a bit with the idea that Matthew's not very exact. But the conflict of the accounts, he tells them to go on to Galilee, mm-hmm. and they'll see him there, mm-hmm. but then they hang around and they meet him on the road to Emmaus, and there's an upper room incident with Thomas and stuff. And then when Matthew has him going on to Galilee, it sounds like in Matthew that the ascension actually takes place in Galilee,
right?
Whereas Luke has him back near Bethany. Mm-hmm. Is that just again?
It's the nature of the way Matthew writes, is the detail about when you go and whether you stay there or don't stay there. None of that stuff is important to Matthew. That's just the style of his writing. And what's interesting is he's consistently that way. So, you know, that's not just an ad hoc explanation to reconcile him. I mean, at every step along the line, Matthew is doing that, is not giving you the kind of details that allows you to get a realistic picture of it.
So does... What, Ehrman? Is that how you said his name?
Bart Ehrman.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Is he assuming that everybody who goes to seminary comes out of seminary having bought into this, like his way of thinking about things? I mean, it doesn't seem very likely.
Well, he probably has a certain class of seminaries in mind, mm-hmm. and I would imagine that it's a fairly accurate generalization that people who go to that class of seminaries do go out roughly being persuaded of something like what they have learned and what he's presenting.
I'm just thinking a little bit about when I went to college in Kentucky. I lived there for 4 years.
That was your mistake.
Yeah, and I went to probably half a dozen different churches based on my ability to get rides to them, both mostly, and then visited a bunch of others. And I would say, maybe with one or two exceptions, I would say those pastors, if they had gone to a seminary that taught that, they somewhere along the line made the decision that wasn't right, and they weren't going to, mm-hmm. they weren't, I mean, maybe these people could talk a good game, but no, it wasn't right, and they weren't going to buy into it.
Well, my guess is that he would, there are seminaries out there that are very intent on staying faithful to their denominational distinctives and that their denominational culture and so on. And if those are conservative Bible-believing cultures, then their seminaries are going to be that as well. And I think he's probably just sort of saying, well, that's a whole different matter. That those are people who are committed to not looking at the data that the mm-hmm. historical critical approach is looking at. And of course they don't believe it because they haven't even considered the evidence and haven't even looked at it. I'm just guessing, but I would guess that that's the kind of thing you would say.
I'm with you on a Wednesday crucifixion.
Okay.
Can you help me understand the day of first day of unleavened bread and Passover?
Mm-hmm.
What days are we talking about there?
Well, the day Jesus was crucified is Passover. So he's crucified on Passover, which is not a Sabbath. What happens on Passover is you do the feasting. So after sundown Tuesday night, in my chronology here, after sundown Tuesday night begins Passover. And the first thing you do on Passover is you have the feast, the Passover feast. That's what Jesus celebrated, I think, is what we call the Last Supper. So he celebrated Passover with his disciples Tuesday night. Then into the wee hours of the morning, he makes his way to the Garden of Gethsemane, where eventually the temple guard comes and arrests him and takes him back to Caiaphas' house for a trial. that's where the Peter's denials happen during that time. We're in the wee hours of the morning. And then as you come toward dawn, right around dawn probably is when the Sanhedrin is coming together to finally try him and pass judgment. And by 9:30 that morning, he's on the cross. Is that right? Roughly 9:30, I think. And then he's, by 3 in the afternoon or so, he has died. And then between then and sundown, all the preparations for his burial has to take place. So that's that's before sundown on Wednesday. Thursday then is a Sabbath. And then Friday is when the women buy spices and prepare spices. Saturday again is a Sabbath. And then early Sunday morning is when they go to visit the tomb.
Okay, so in Luke, where it says in Luke 22:7, quote, "Then came the first day of unleavened bread on which the Passover lamb had to be sacrificed, and he sent Peter and John, saying, go and prepare this Passover." Oh. So is that a foreshadowing statement, that first verse?
You're confused because he calls it the first day of unleavened bread,
which is the Passover.
Right. Because the Passover, technically in Exodus, you have the Passover, and then you have 7 days of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. But apparently they lump those together. So they called the whole thing the Feast of Unleavened Bread, with the Passover being the first of those days. That's, I think, how he's using his language. Because technically, according to the law, the Passover is distinct from the Feast of Unleavened Bread. But to identify the Passover as the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread is to simply lump them together. And that's reasonable. I mean,
okay, thanks. Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that traditional Christianity, historical Christianity, we've grown up with the idea that there are two different ways of knowing. There's the way of knowing that we use for ordinary stuff, non-religious stuff, and then there's a way of knowing that we use for religious stuff. And I think intuitively we recognize there's a problem with that. And as a young Christian, I actually spent about 10 years as a functional atheist because I couldn't see, I had all sorts of questions that people would just tell me, you know, just believe, and it just didn't, they didn't make any sense. Nobody could give me any good answers. And when I finally became a Christian, it was almost against my will, I guess, because there was something in me that I think it was sort of tacitly, I realized there's something going on here, but I really needed those answers. And then God blessed me by bringing me into this community, and I actually started getting some of them. I was very vulnerable, made very vulnerable by the belief that there are two different ways of knowing. I mean, I've had people that I love and respect who buy into this idea that when I tell them I have reasons for what I believe, they say, "Well, what good is your faith then?
Right.
What's the point of faith?" And so when you run into somebody like Ehrman or the people that he's talking about who persuaded them, they are coming up with a way of explaining the data that uses the way of knowing that we're used to using. And we are not used to using right. that same process.
If you let me cut you off because I want to make sure I have enough time.
Okay.
But let me just underline what I think is the point you're making.
Okay.
That, yes, I agree with Ehrman that there is no separate way of knowing religious things. Faith is not some other way of knowing. The only way of knowing is the way of common sense and rationality and reason, which is exactly what Ehrman is appealing to. And I applaud him for that. I agree with him. I'm on the same page with him with that. And my problem with the historical critical method is that it has some a priori assumptions that I think are just false. And until those assumptions can be defended, his conclusions don't follow. But I want to talk a little bit more about that before I run out of time here. This process that I've used to reconstruct the event of the empty tomb and the event of Peter's denials. This is, it's a common way of reasoning. I meant to check on this. I think this is right. The name doesn't matter, but I think it's what logicians might call, or philosophers might call, abductive reasoning. What is abductive reasoning? Abductive reasoning looks at, it's the kind of reasoning that any detective would use. So it's commonplace for us. I mean, we see a detective story on TV every day, and we see how they piece together the crime scene and the event of the crime. They take a bit of an eyewitness testimony here and an eyewitness testimony there and an eyewitness testimony here and a piece of forensic evidence here and a piece of forensic evidence there. And how does their reasoning go? I can tell you a story that can account for every one of those testimonies and every piece of evidence. I can tell you a story that can plausibly and coherently account for that. You got a better story? If you got a better story, then I'll believe yours. But if you don't got a better story, I'm betting my story's true. I'm willing to take that to the bank because I can account for all the evidence. That's abductive reasoning. It's not deductive. You're not deducing that this is how the event went down. So you don't have certainty. You weren't an eyewitness, right? You weren't there. So you don't know what actually happened, but you have pieced together from all these fragments of evidence a story that makes sense of every piece of evidence that you have been able to garner. And on the basis that you have multiple pieces of evidence, what are the odds that you could tell a story that's going to account for all of those pieces of evidence without it being true? The odds are that if your story can account for all the evidence, it's probably true. How do you refute that kind of reasoning? You come up with a better argument. And that's exactly how the prosecutor and the defense attorney go at it in the courtroom. The prosecutor tells his story, and the defense attorney comes along and says, I think I got a better explanation for the evidence than he does. At least a good defense attorney would be doing that. And the jury has to decide who's telling the better story or who's giving the more plausible account. We use that all the time, that kind of reasoning. Most of the most important things we believe on the basis of abductive reasoning. I believe in the existence of God on the basis of abductive reasoning. You can't deduce the existence of God, and it's not induction. It's not every God I've ever seen looks like this, so that I know God when I see one. Our belief in the existence of God is that we look around at reality and all the multifaceted experiences and events and things that are there, all the vast ocean of evidence there is out there, and we tell ourselves a story. There's a creator, and that creator God that exists can account for why my life goes the way my life goes and why history goes the way history goes and why the world is the way the world is. I think that account can make it all plausible. If it can't, or if you can come up with a better account that is a more plausible account for all of that same information, then I should be believing that instead. But I'm convinced that no better story can be told that explains our life, our experience, and our reality than the existence of a creator God. That's abductive reasoning. Well, Ehrman is making a strange claim. Remember that quote that I read, that how absurd it is to think that my gospel account that I have reconstructed from the pieces of evidence is truer than the partial accounts that you find in the Gospels? That's exactly what you would expect when you use abductive reasoning. I mean, he might as well say to the detective, who do you think you are? You think you have a truer account than that eyewitness? After having listened to 10 eyewitnesses and taken some forensic evidence, you think you have a truer account than that eyewitness? What detective wouldn't say, yeah? Yeah, I do. Because I have taken more things into account. than any given eyewitness has. So, of course, having reconstructed, I mean, that's exactly the position that we're in, is that with four Gospels, we have four different sources of information, and therefore it allows us to put together a fuller and truer account than any one Gospel account itself could supply to us. That just stands to reason. Now, I think what Ehrman would say is, and here's the irony, he claims to be working as a historian, and yet he rejects the very method that allows historians to operate, the abductive reasoning. Really? I mean, that is just weird. But I think the criticism that he would make of my reconstruction, to answer your question, I think the criticism he would make is, well, but the historian can only construct a truer account from several different eyewitness accounts if those eyewitness accounts are reliable. Only if they are reliable can you put them together and come up with the truth. But that's just it, Jack. These are not reliable accounts. Okay, these are not reliable accounts. And how do we know they're not reliable accounts? Well, because look at how incoherent they are. You mean you see the circle? I know they're unreliable because they're incoherent. Ah, but I can make them coherent. Yeah, but they're unreliable, so you can't do that. It's a logical circle, a circular argument that I think is the fatal flaw in their position. Because we don't know if they're reliable until we've tested them. And I think that in looking at these accounts in particular, they're remarkably coherent, remarkably consistent with one another. If we allow ourselves to reconstruct from all the different sources a full and true account of what actually went down. Now, why do I reconstruct the event, these accounts and try to get to the real event itself in order to respond to someone like Bart Ehrman? Not really. I mean, I do that, but I would be doing this anyway because I think there's no way to do exegesis of the Gospels without looking at all the Gospels together in parallel with each other and using the information that you get from each of these testimonies separately, reconstruct what really went down, because only by knowing what really went down can I judge the nature of the intrinsic nature of the individual account that Matthew has given me, or that Mark has given me, or that Luke has given me, or that John has given me. I don't know how to read Matthew until I can compare his account against the event. And how can I get the event without reconstructing it from all the other Gospels? That's what I have to do. So I would be doing this just simply to understand the Gospel accounts themselves, quite apart from responding to critics of the Gospel. But in the process of doing that, of course, we have seen that, in fact, these are not incoherent and irreconcilable events like Bart Ehrman suggests. Okay, any quick, I only have 10 minutes. Any quick questions before we, yeah?
I'm thinking of something I read in The Language of God. People look at the Bible for loopholes. They look for reasons to support their unbelief. And this is the feel I'm getting. I've done it. I got challenged on it, and it was one of my flashbulb moments where I saw my motivation.
I'm sorry, I'm not. What you mean you've done it? What?
I've done the looking in the Bible for loopholes.
Ah, I see.
Looking for reasons to reject.
Uh-huh.
Because I don't want this to be true because of what it tells me, who I am, who I'm responsible to, what moral reality looks like, and what I look like.
Right.
And so if I can find enough loopholes to piece together, I've got a cloak to cover myself against that cold breeze.
Right. No, that's right.
You said faith is not a different kind of knowledge or reasoning. Mm-hmm. But what seems really clear is that it is in a way, in that, or help me, because it feels different in the sense that faith is what makes you want to be that detective to put the pieces together, whereas unbelief
makes you unwilling to go there. It's right. Makes you hostile. Right. Rather, so and so my point is, no detective is ever hostile to the evidence. Can you help me with? Well, at least
bad detectives.
Bad detectives, but Sherlock Holmes or whoever.
Right, right.
Can you help me with?
Well, yeah. See, ultimately, what makes you and I children of God is not that we've figured stuff out. What makes us children of God is that the Spirit of God has worked in our insides to give us a passion to know God, to love God, to serve God, and so on. And when we have a passion to know God, then we're going to be open to the evidence about God in a way that we otherwise might be hostile to it, antagonistic to it, or closed to it. But that doesn't give me a different way of knowing. It just means the way of knowing that every human being has is now going to work right. I'm not going to block it with my prejudice and with my closeness, the kind of thing that Bill was talking about, my desire for loopholes.
Would you say it's not a different way of knowing as far as rationality, but it is a different way of seeing?
It's a different way of being.
Being.
Okay. It's a different way, and therefore a different way of seeing. Exactly.
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
One more, Jack. I'm mathematically challenged, so okay. I'll admit it right up front.
Okay.
I have a two-part question. I remember in Scripture where Christ says that when he goes into the tomb or if they kill him, he will rise in 3 days. Is there a reference to nights also? So it sounds like somebody
yes,
said.
Yes, in the only once, I think. But it's in the account where he says, it's in Luke 12, and he says, just as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the earth, okay. So will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the...
Well, that's where my math challenge comes up.
Yeah.
In what you're talking about with the Wednesday night death, am I correct, of Christ,
mm-hmm.
Then I see Thursday, Friday, Saturday, he rises on Sunday morning early, right?
Well, see, we don't know when he rose.
Okay. But that's still 3 days. That's Thursday, Friday, Saturday, so
right.
I don't have a problem.
Right.
But sounds like four nights, unless, like Christmas, our Easter Sunday celebration is a nice celebration, but it's not really the day, right? I mean, we know that Christmas isn't when Christ was born.
Well, he's in the grave Wednesday night, Thursday night, wait, Tuesday night, Wednesday.
Four nights.
Yeah, Wednesday night, Thursday night, Friday night, going into Saturday. Okay, then right, he could have raised as early as sundown on Saturday. So he gets the three nights and the 3 days. Then he raises from the dead. We don't know when he raised from the dead.
Okay.
All we know is that the angel of the Lord came down early that morning and scared the guards and rolled the stone away to reveal an empty tomb. I mean, oftentimes, again, our pictures have Jesus coming out of the tomb in that scene. That's not what any of the gospel accounts say. Jesus may be long gone when the stone is rolled away.
So where did the early church get the whole concept of Easter Sunday? Because we've always taught that he rose on Sunday.
Well, this seems to be a long-standing tradition that he was crucified on Good Friday, mm-hmm. on Friday, the Sabbath on Saturday, and then he raised and they visited the empty tomb on Sunday. I don't know. I think it's just by not... Well, I mean, you can understand that if you don't try to reconstruct the events from the four Gospels, if you just looked at Matthew, for example, Matthew could certainly lend itself to that interpretation, if that's all you had to go on, because Matthew's not telling you enough to be able to think otherwise. So I imagine it's just somebody was not paying enough attention and came up with that scenario, and it became part of tradition. And we know that if it's traditional, it doesn't go away.
As you've pointed out, the church also lost its Jewish roots fairly early on. The Jewish readers would have known all of this. It would have been something they did every year.
Right.
So we're strangers
right.
eavesdropping on another time and other people.
It took me years as a Bible teacher to realize that Sabbath doesn't necessarily mean the weekly Sabbath. Yeah. if that's lost, that's very, you know, what else are you going to do with it except make that on Saturday? So, okay, let me just end with this. This is the next example he gives, leaving the empty tunes behind. I'm quoting from his book now. As we will see, there are lots of other discrepancies in the New Testament, some of them far more difficult to reconcile, virtually impossible, I would say, than these simple examples. It is interesting, however, that he starts with Peter's denials and the empty tombs, because anyone I've ever met that rejects inerrancy says those are proof positive that the Bible is not inerrant. It's Peter's denials and the empty tombs that there's no way in the world that those are reconcilable, so there's no way in the world we can believe the Bible is inerrant. So it's interesting he starts with what most people think are the big guns. But he says, some of them far more difficult to reconcile, virtually impossible, I would say, than these simple examples. Not only are there discrepancies among different books of the Bible, but there are also inconsistencies with some of the books, a problem that historical critics have long ascribed to the fact that gospel writers used different sources for their accounts. You follow? He's stitching together different stories that have been told. They're different sources. And sometimes these sources, when spliced together, stood at odds with one another. It's amazing how internal problems like these, if you're not alerted to them, are so easily passed by when you read the Gospels, but how when someone points them out, they seem so obvious. Students often ask me, why didn't I see this before? For example, in John's Gospel, Jesus performs his first miracle in chapter 2. That's the turning water into wine. When he turns the water into wine, a favorite miracle story on college campuses. And we're told that this was the first sign that Jesus did, John 2:11. Later in that chapter, we're told that Jesus did many signs in Jerusalem, John 2:25. So in John's account, he turns the water into wine in Cana. He goes to a Passover celebration in Jerusalem. So he journeys down to Jerusalem and has Passover there. That's when he cleanses the temple for the first time. Remember, we looked at that. When he drives the money changers out of the temple and so on. During that event, John goes on to say, and he performed, that's what's interesting. He says, we're told that Jesus did many signs. No Greek text has many in it. I'm not sure why. I mean, I imagine it's an inadvertent slip, but, you know, in his mind, he did many signs, but it doesn't actually say that. It says many believed. He performs signs and many believed. Later in that chapter, we're told that Jesus did many signs in Jerusalem. And then in chapter 4, he heals the son of a centurion, and the author says this was the second sign that Jesus did. Huh? One sign, many signs, and then the second sign? And so he's just basically throwing out that out there as a discrepancy. But the fact of the matter is that if you read the account carefully, he says this is the second time that Jesus performed when he came, having come back into Galilee. I think it's quite apparent from John's account that John is intentionally saying, let me count the signs that were performed in Galilee, which is his home district where he spent most of his time. The first one was the turning of the water into wine in Cana, and the second one was the healing of this centurion's son. And that was the second one. Well, John can count. He would know that he performed signs in Jerusalem, but he's focused on, in the early part of his gospel account, he's focused on the events that transpired in Galilee. It's not until the end that he changes his focus. So he's indicating that it's the second one. There's not even an apparent discrepancy there, let alone a real discrepancy there. John is, I think, quite clear. If you go and look at that account, it's quite clear that the way to read that is that John intends you to know that this is the second thing that happened in the vicinity of Capernaum, where he's making the focus of his ministry. This was the second one that occurred. The reason I even spend any time on that at all is that notice at that point how tendentious Ehrman is becoming. I mean, that's terrible evidence. If you want to persuade me that the Bible is not trustworthy, don't be doing that. I mean, you're trying to make a problem one where all I have to do is read it and see that there's no problem there. That's not even saying what you're arguing that it's saying. I need to let you go. Let's pray. Father, in this season when we celebrate the birth of the one that you sent to be our Savior and to be our Lord and to be our King forever in the eternal kingdom of God, Lord, I just pray that you'll burn it into our hearts that this is for real, this is actual, this is true, this is who you are and what you're doing with us and about us and for us, and that we might believe it and with a passion to serve you and know you and honor you and belong to you for all eternity. In Jesus' name, amen.